Here we are once again. Time for the rock trivia, music trivia slash commentaries from yours truly. Excuse me. Many of you may have recognized that last piece I played, which really has not a whole lot to do with tonight's topic. I'm going to be mixing a trivia session with the topic of boundaries and how to appreciate them, how to respect your own as well as other people, since we seem to be having a onslaught of folks, no pun intended, excuse me, who don't seem to know what those are and how to respect them in other folks. The piece I just played, of course, is a Greg Lake piece from his time with ELP. I suspect Peter Sinfield had a hand in that, but I can't be sure about that one. Most of you may or may not know that Peter Sinfield was a lyricist that worked sometimes with Greg Lake in ELP and had worked with him previously in Greg Lake's prior band, who many of you probably know, but in case you don't, Greg Lake got his start with King Crimson, with Robert Fripp and gang, so to speak, and excuse me, did the first two recordings with them in the Court of the Crimson King and in the Wake of Poseidon, and was lured away to play with Keith Emerson. Emerson's band, of course, prior to that was The Nice, and Carl Palmer's band prior to that was playing with a band called Atomic Rooster, which sort of came out of Carl Palmer's work with an artist that has been started sort of this theatrical things back in Britain in the late 60s, mid to late 60s, Arthur Brown, who had this act he called the Crazy World of Arthur Brown and would run around with all sorts of gear. This was sort of pre-Peter Gabriel Genesis period, just before that, around the same time period. And besides just having a freaking fabulous voice, got one of the best screamy voices on the planet. Arthur Brown was just a really creative guy back in the day, and had Carl Palmer at 19 playing drums with him on his iconic song, probably his only top 40 hit, which is, you know, Fire. You know, I am the God of Hellfire. And that's Carl Palmer at around 19 playing on that, along with Vincent Crane on keyboards. Vincent Crane later took Carl Palmer and formed Atomic Rooster, and that's kind of how they came to get to be. And Vincent Crane for a long time was sort of the, it was this big sort of battle, if you will, between him and Keith Emerson, both of whom were really fabulous keyboardists, if any of you know. And, you know, it was all this big hoopla because back in the day, Vincent Crane was supposed to be this really nasty guy that, you know, was hard to work with and was constantly changing band members and bitching at people and having temper tantrums and yada yada, you know, which is not atypical for most rock stars today or back in the day or whenever. And people just, I think originally, and, you know, I did too, chalked it up to him being kind of a jerk. And no offense, because a lot of rock stars are jerks. But come to find out later, after his suicide in the late 80s, that he was a longtime bipolar sufferer who evidently didn't take his meds appropriately or didn't take his meds at all and or substituted other things for them, which is pretty common and sad but true with a lot of bipolars. So, you know, it was also the case with, you know, Jaco Pastorius, a really great jazz bass player who I've talked about before also. When I did my podcast talking about, you know, really cool bass players. Excuse me. So it's just unfortunate that things like that happen to folks. You know, when Greg Lake got with ELP and did their first recording, most of you know, if you know ELP at all, you might know that song I just played. You might know Still You Turn Me On. But the song you probably know by them most, if you know anything by them, in a sort of a passing fashion, unless you're kind of an ELP freak like I am. You probably know Lucky Man, which was off their first recording, which is also a Greg Lake acoustic tune. Greg Lake played bass and acoustic and electric guitar with them as well. He's a really talented guy. Got one of the greatest vocals in rock music, I think, in my personal opinion. Just a fabulous voice. At any rate, according to my understanding, when they were recording the first record, Lucky Man is not like anything else on the recording. So if you hear any of the other stuff like Take a Pebble or The Barbarian or any of that kind of stuff, it's just, it's very, very heavy, classically influenced organ, you know, keyboards, all kind of cool stuff. It's just very dramatic and just really an amazing recording for today. And actually for any day, but just really amazing for that time period. And they were, according to my understanding, they were at the end of the recording sessions, and they had like 4 minutes left on the, to fill up the recording with. And Greg Lake goes, "Well, I had the song I wrote when I was like 15 years old, and kind of goes like this." And that was Lucky Man, and that ended up being probably their most recognizable song to date. So it's kind of interesting how things like that happen. So I guess one never knows. excuse me, of course, EOP has gone in and out, and, they've taken hiatuses, and Greg Lake's done solo work, and Keith Emerson has also, and Keith Emerson has a thing currently he does, too, called, I think, the Keith Emerson Band, and Carl Palmer, of course, has gone on to play with the supergroup Asia, with John Wenton on bass, who also played with King Crimson back in the day. He actually replaced Greg Lake in King Crimson at one time. And when John Wenton, for a brief time, was out of Asia, Greg Lake replaced him on a tour when they were doing Japan. I actually saw a video of that. And given that I really like Greg Lake's voice, I mean, nothing wrong with John Wenton's voice, obviously. I just really love Greg Lake and his bass play. He's a really super bass player as well. I think he's a very underrated bass player. Listen to his thing on his bass playing on the King Crimson stuff, 21st Century Schizoid Man. It's just amazing, the stuff he's playing on that stuff. He's no slouch with EOP either, but, in later years, he's kind of gone to a more simplistic bass line, but you listen to some of the early stuff with King Crimson and the early to mid-career of ELP, even through like brain salad surgery and stuff, he's hitting some really, really tasty bass licks for sure. At any rate, of course, Carl Palmer being the drummer and Jeffrey Downs being the keyboard player for Asia, who also played with Yes at one time and started out with the band The Buggles, who had the first ever video shown on MTV back in the day, Video Kill the Radio Star. That's a Buggles song. Again, if you know nothing but The Buggles but one song, that's the song you know by them, and that was the very first video that MTV ever played in their inception. So he also has a pretty lengthy career. And then, of course, Steve Howe, the guitarist, most notably known for his work with Yes. So they were that's why they're considered a quote unquote super group, because they had folks from ELP and Yes and King Crimson, which, arguably are certainly three very well received so called progressive prog rock bands, and have remained so pretty much throughout their career. So it's real interesting how things like that happen. A keyboard player for King Crimson, Ian McDonald, eventually ended up, which most of you probably don't know, ended up with Foreigner, which seems like a, kind of a huh, because I don't think anybody would accuse Foreigner of being a prog rock band. And I'm not slamming Foreigner at all, because, I really like them a lot. They're a really cool band, and they've certainly gone through some changes themselves over the years, personnel-wise, and, they've had their fair share of issues. As most of you know, the lead singer has had, brain issues for a while. I'm not sure if it's Alzheimer's. I know at one point he had a tumor, which is why he's not singing with the band anymore. And the guy they got is really good. I've seen them with the new lead singer, the so-called new lead singer. He's been with them for a while now. But, Foreigner was getting together, Ian McDonald was the original keyboard player with them, and he also plays sax. Also, he's a pretty versatile guy. He's played with a lot of folks on studio sessions, and so you've got a lot of folks who make a lot of ground, so to speak, if you will. It's kind of amazing how that happens. But I've always liked that song I played at the beginning of this, and I was sort of reminded that I did a workout earlier today. I do my, most of you know if I that I work out pretty regularly, and I usually do my, just due to my sleep disorder, I usually do my workouts around the witching hour. So I start my workout around 11:45 and go to about 1 or 1:15, yeah, a.m. So, you know, well, you know, I'm up to 5:30, 6 o'clock every day. So it's just, you know, it's part of my circadian rhythm sleep disorder that I inherited from my mom. Thanks. And my mom's side of the family, most of the males on that side have it, and it's pretty annoying. It's one of those dealies where my clock has sort of shifted about 6.5 or 7 hours north. So when most normal people are going to bed sometime between, you know, 10 and 12 in the evening, I'm going to bed about, you know, anywhere from 4:30, if I'm lucky, 4 to 4:30, to, you know, upwards of 6, 6:30, 7 o'clock. So it's pretty annoying. And it's, you know, if you can trace it back to childhood and you have more than one immediate family member, close, you know, direct family member that had it, and just about every male on my mom's side of the family has got it, and I've had it since I was a little kid, you can pretty much put your head between your legs and kiss your tush goodbye. You're going to have it the rest of your life, and that has certainly been the case with me. And unfortunately, it seems to be getting worse as I get older. I used to be able to, back in the day, I used to be able to go to bed about midnight or 1 o'clock or 2 a.m., and you know, by the time I was in grad school, that was, you know, 3 and 4 a.m., and then, boy, that played hell on my internship. Let me tell you, at the VA, having to be there at 8 o'clock, ooh, and I don't mean 8 p.m. either, boys and girls. That was all kinds of fun. It's probably the most miserable year I've spent as an adult. certainly my most sleep-deprived, grouchy year, that's for dadgum sure. But yeah, that's just one of those things that I've had to contend with, and since addictions, and you guys have heard the story, since addictions run on both sides of my family, I decided it's probably not a really good idea for me to try any kind of sedative hypnotics or any sleeping medications, even though the new versions of them, you know, which claim to be non-addicting, all that kind of junk. And I'm like, yeah, right. And I don't have a shitload of guitars either. Yeah. Oops, did I say that? Yeah, I just, when it comes to that kind of stuff, I just don't trust, it. You know, I'd rather adjust my sleep schedule and operate as best I can. And, you know, it's just what I do, and I do the best I can. And, you know, it's not like everybody doesn't have something they got to deal with, right? So I joke with my folks a lot. Well, I used to joke with them. Unfortunately, both of my parents have had strokes, and it has affected their abilities to process information on a pretty significant manner. And it's surely pretty sad, because my mom is a person who had 10 IQ points in me, and I'm no slouch, and that's no brag, just fact. I'm a fairly bright guy, and my mom would make mincemeat of me pretty easily before she had her multi-infarcts. So known these days more as trans ischemic attacks, TIAs. Just really sad to see that. But at any rate, you know, I used to joke with her about, you know, if all the things I could have inherited from the, you know, my dad's side of the family, my mom's side of the family, the sleep disorder from her side of the family, she's, you know, got the OCD thing going, and I've got the OCPD thing going, the obsessive compulsive personality disorder, which is kind of a wussier version of OCD. And my dad and mom both had the addictions on both sides, which I did not get. And my dad's got all the cluster B personality disorders, most notably narcissistic, antisocial, and borderlines run rampant in his family. So, and so do ADHD and multiple ILDs. So I did get some of the learning disorder stuff. Thanks, Dad. But of all the stuff I could have gotten, you know, some LDs and my sleep disorder and my perfectionistic traits that kind of drive myself and everybody else around me nuts from time to time, I could have done a whole lot worse. And I am just uber thankful I did not get the cluster B personality disorders. Thank you, God. Nor did I get the ADHD. Thank you, Jesus. nor the addictions, which is really the miracle. So, you know, sometimes you dodge the bullet and you get lucky, and sometimes the fragments hit you in the patootie, and that was kind of the case in my situation. So I'm not complaining. I'm really not. At any rate, really, really always love those acoustic pieces, and I've always had sort of this split personality, so to speak, in terms of music, because I've tended to be sort of, I joke about being bipolar in my music taste. I tend to like either very hard rock, heavy metal-y kinds of things of the classic rock genre, not this newer stuff. I've probably mentioned this before, you know, and I'm certainly no offense to the folks that do this kind of music, because obviously you're a whole lot more successful as a musician than I ever will be, and you're making a whole lot more money than I ever will, and there's a whole lot of people that know you and like you than they do me, so, you know, who the hell am I, right? But I've never had an affinity for the, as I like to jokingly refer to them, cookie monster metal vocalists, those guys and gals in some cases too, that sound like they're constipated and they're trying to, you know, as Beavis and Butthead would say, pinch a loaf and, you know, force it out. And I'm just like, guys, that's what they have X-Lax for. You know, you don't take a mic into the bathroom when you're trying to poop and you're constipated and go, oh, I'm trying to poop now. I just, oh my God. Sorry, people. That's not singing in my opinion. You know, you guys have heard it from me before, I'm sure, but I'm very partial to tenors when it comes to rock, and so I don't have a lot of respect for folks who aren't tenors and try to sing rock music, which is why I hate my own vocals. Acoustic guys and gals get away with all kinds of stuff, that's fine. If you're an R&B person or whatever, that's fine, but to me, real hard rockers need to be tenors. There's very, 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 very few exceptions to that. Jack Bruce being amongst them, who I absolutely adore his vocals, and he is definitely not a tenor, but that guy's just so amazingly gifted in every realm possible in the music business that one can only sit back and shake their head and be envious of a multi-instrumentalist, singer, songwriter, whatever. I mean, the guy's just a genius, and he's definitely not a tenor. You know, I love his stuff. There's a couple of tenors out there that I really hate, too, that just really get on my nerves. But in general, and obviously for politeness, I won't be mentioning their names. But and some of them are very, very well-liked and make a whole lot of money, just like the Cookie Monster guys and gals. So, you know, more power to them. That's just not my cup of tea. Paul Rodgers is the other non-tenor. He's got kind of a weird voice to categorize, but love his vocals, just one of the best pure rock vocalists we have, still to this day has maintained his vocal prowess incredibly well. It's just amazing to me how he hits the stuff he does. He's just really, he also is a multi-instrumentalist, not as much as somebody like Jack Bruce or Felix Pappalardi, but he's definitely a, you know, a decent pianist and guitar player, on top of being just a fantabulous vocalist. You know, if all he did was have the vocals he had, he'd be good enough, right? But no, you know, some of us schmucks have to, you know, be glad we could even, you know, strum a six string. At any rate, there's a lot of really good folks out there, so I'm really happy for all of you that are making money on the music business in any way, shape, or form you do, and I don't have to like you to take my hat off to you, so to speak. And, you know, folks have heard me say that before. I'm really snooty about what kind of music I like. I'm really particular. And sometimes there's no deciphering why I like somebody or why I don't like somebody. Because, you know, a lot of folks, people think I would love, I just really despise. And people that think, you know, folks that they would never think me as liking, I really like. So I, you know, I guess I'm just weird. And, you know, like, duh, you needed to, you know, like, that's a big revelation, dude. You know, you guys have probably already figured that out already, right? Oh my gosh. So having said all that, that's kind of a nice intro to my topic, on a more serious note. Yeah, I know my jokes never get any better. What you gonna do, right? Of boundaries and personal boundary spaces. And for those of you who don't know, you know, think of it as sort of one's comfort zone, if you will. You know, boundaries are not just physical. They're, you know, sort of psychological, emotional, if you will, as well as physical. And I think a lot of people get, you know, that you don't intrude on somebody's physical boundary space, although, you know, as you folks have heard me say before, given the series of events that have happened recently in Boston and in Ohio, One might think that some people in the public just don't get that it's not okay to go, you know, raping people and beating the crap out of people and blowing people up. And it's just like, you know, oh my God, what an inconvenience. You mean I can't do that shit when I want to? That is definitely a boundary intrusion, which I think most of you guys and gals out there probably figure that out for yourself without, you know, somebody with as much education as me telling you that. But evidently some folks don't know it because, you know, that kind of crap happens on a pretty regular basis. Somebody's mugged or raped or robbed or, you know, whatever. And all of those are various forms of boundary transgressions, as we call it in the shrink world. You know, basically you not minding your own business and sticking your nose and fist and other body parts. Okay, that was a pretty good one for a judge. Okay, come on. Give me some slack here, guys. Where the way it doesn't belong, you know, or in some cases, lead pipes or bullets or knives or bombs. But, and I think most people get that. It kind of becomes tricky in other situations. You know, one of the questions I got several podcasts back from one of the listeners who sent a podcast question in for me that I talked about, and I'll reiterate it a little bit here. It has to do with, you know, parents and what's an appropriate, you know, boundary space for you know, adult kids who are having to deal with their elderly parents, or, you know, who may or may not appreciate them very much or may not treat them very nicely. And, you know, I tell everybody, you know, adults have equal, if you will, boundary rights. And, you know, just because you're a parent of somebody, or just because you're a cousin of somebody, just because you're somebody's kid, doesn't give you the right to act like an asshole. Excuse my French, but, you know, that's just being blunt, you know. And just because you're a parent doesn't give you special get-out-of-jail-free cards to not treat your kid appropriately when your kid does something nice. I don't care if your kid is 5, 15, or 50. You know, I tell everybody, you know, and you guys and gals have heard me say this before, you know, rules apply to everybody. Nature is an equal opportunity bigot. Well, so are boundaries. Okay? So one of the things I often say to most of the folks that I work with, you know, as I can tell them, don't do drugs. You know, I don't do illicit drugs, with the rare exception of alcohol on rare occasions, and every now and then cigars, and every now and then a pipe, you know, but not very often. And I've never been drunk, as most of you heard me say before, and I don't do other drugs of abuse. Now, as far as food, quote-unquote drugs, well, yeah, duh. The only other drug that I do that some people go, you know, rolling their eyes going, oh, dude, please, but come on, it's a drug, is caffeine. I don't do very much of that, but occasionally I'll drink non-decaffeinated coffee. And I do theophylline, which is a caffeine derivative that's usually in tea. And I do that more than I do caffeine. But I usually do de-theophylinated tea. Most people say it's decaffeinated, but it's really not caffeine, it's theophylline. And I know it's my compulsivity showing what, you know, quel surprise on that front too, right? No. So, you know, other than that, I don't really do drugs. I don't eat sugar hardly ever, unless it's, you know, put in something I'm eating at a restaurant. I don't eat out very often. And I don't cook with sugar. I don't, you know, eat foods with sugar in it almost never. On rare occasions, I'll do something like I'll make royal icing, which has confectioner sugar in it, and I'll use some confectioner sugar and some honey and some stevia or whatever, but I generally don't cook with sugar. Don't eat crappy foods. It's just, you know, I'm trying to respect my body such as it is. And, you know, that for me is a boundary. You know, it'd be like somebody, you know, fixing a food for me and not telling me there's sugar in it and leading me to believe that there isn't sugar in it. That's a boundary transgression, right? So if I don't care how old you are, I don't care what race you are, sex you are, creed, nationality, religion, atheist, whatever, you know, if it's a good idea not to bitch smack somebody just out of the blue, that applies to everybody, right? And so I tell people, if people aren't treating you the way that you think a common rule of thumb would tell you that anybody in society would want to be treated, you have the right to tell them no and walk out. You know, I don't care if it's your kid, I don't care if it's your parents. You know, your kinship to somebody is not an excuse for inappropriate boundary transgressions. So think of boundaries as personal spaces. And, you know, all of us have it. Some of us have more rigid and more distant, if you will. We need more space, you know, some of that than other people do. And some of that gets, you know, shown in how much we socialize and like to be around other people, or as in my case, almost a, you know, a l'ermite, a hermit. And I'm not a very much social animal. I can always get away with that because if I've got a guitar or bass in my hand or playing keyboards or whatever, you know, I'm in the studio doing stuff for other folks, and so it looks like, you know, I'm on stage or whatever. It looks like I'm, you know, being all this social guy, and oh yeah, and he's really out there and playing stuff, and you know, but it's really a front. Okay, I'm really using the instrument as a mediational tool between the audience and me, right? Because if it's just me sitting there chatting with the audience, I'm not a chatty kind of guy. You know, my stage presence is very minimal. You know, if I've got an electric guitar in my hand, I'm probably jumping around and doing splits and all sorts of obscene things with my flying V on stage, but, but for real. But anyway, that's another story. But, you know, it's because the music is moving me. I'm getting into the spiritual, you know, existential, you know, zen of the moment, so to speak. But, you know, I'm really not paying very much attention to what people in the audience are doing. I really could care less, to be perfectly honest with you. I play music for me. It's my way to disconnect. It's my way to get inside myself and get close to God. And I'm really serious when I say that. Music for me is a very spiritual thing. It's not about money. It's not about, obviously, it's not about drugs. It's not about sex. And it's not that I don't like sex, but music for me is not a vehicle to snag folks for sexual encounters. It never has been. That's not true. It probably was when I was a teenager and fat and disgusting and self-loathing. But now that I'm not fat and disgusting but still self-loathing, the music for me has transcended all of that stuff a long time ago. And in all seriousness, it's a very spiritual thing for me, which is why I don't play songs I don't like, which is why I don't play music I don't like, which is why I don't listen to music I don't like. I refuse to be around it. It's an anathema to my aura, frankly. And if it isn't to other people, that's great. And part of the boundary is, you know, when you're with me, you listen to the stuff that I like, or we listen to nothing at all. You don't play music I hate. That's a boundary transgression for me. If I go to somebody's house and they're playing music that I don't like, well, you know what? I'm in their house, their rules. I don't like it. It's up to me to leave. He who owns the problem has to fix the problem. And if I'm having the problem with the music, it's my responsibility to ask the host to please turn the music down or off. Or if I consider that to be rude, which I would, I'll just excuse myself and leave because I'm the one with the problem. I need to fix it. So if you're having a problem with somebody being inappropriate with you in some sort of way that it feels boundary transgressional, fix the problem by asking them to stop, change, minimize, maximize, whatever, or get the heck out. Don't feel obligated, right? When you sacrifice your own boundaries, comfortableness, on the altar of other people's happiness, it is really, really self-defeating. And frankly, and I mean no disrespect to you when I say this, dumber than dog shit. You have no duty to anybody if not to yourself first and foremost. If you don't honor yourself and learn to respect yourself and have responsibility within and between yourself and you, then you can't have it with other people. You know, I'm not saying to be narcissistically selfish and, you know, and go fuck you if you don't like it kind of thing, but you have to honor yourself and be true to yourself, right? Even Shakespeare back in the day, as most of you know, you know, Polonius's speech that he gives, you know, at the end of the to Laertes when he's going off is, you know, above all these things to thine own self be true. You know, that's about knowing who you are and honoring yourself first and foremost. So if somebody's transgressing your boundaries, ask them to politely one time to please not do it, and the second time a little strong, and the third time feel free to do whatever it is you got to do to get them to stop, even if that's getting up and leaving. Boundary spaces, I think, have somehow gotten overlooked. Excuse me. Sorry, I had to do that. In our society a lot, and I think, you know, we sometimes suffer, if you will, the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune in interpersonal relationships. Yeah, I know it's my Shakespeare night. What can I tell you? Because we think somehow it's impolite to ask people to stop doing something that we find personally offensive or whatever. And it's not. You know, if they don't want to stop, they have the option to leave. If they, you know, if you're in their presence and it's their room or their house or their car, their rules, don't get back in the car with them next time. And if you can and leave, get up and leave politely, be nice about it. You know, it doesn't get, right? There's never any reason for rudeness. Never, ever, ever. You know, I mean, unless somebody's coming after you and it's, you know, for your life, obviously, or your physical safety, they're wanting to beat the crap out of you or, you know, steal money from you or rape you or whatever, kill you or whatever. Obviously, then you might have to get a little jiggy on them, right? But in general, in most normal, quote unquote, usual and customary social interpersonal relationships, there's never any reason to be rude. Just because somebody acts like a jerk does not give you license to act like a jerk. Right? Just because somebody's being bound or transgressional does not give you the right to transgress their boundaries back. This is not tit for tat. You know, what's the famous Gandhi quote that I love? An eye for an eye leaves the whole world blind. I love that quote. You know, and it's true. You know, this is not about, you know, Hammurabi's code. This is about using what I call common humanitarian sense and asking somebody to honor your boundaries and you honoring theirs. And even if they don't, honor theirs and leave, right? Because if you act really cool and other people are acting like jerks, they look like exactly what they are. You know, you maintain your integrity. You know, as one of my favorite lyrics would say, when the lesser men have everything and the greater ones have naught, will you hold on to morality with the treasures you have wrought? Or will you sell your expertise, your knowledge, and your soul for a piece of false security in the lands of dark and cold? Or will you take the gift promised you by ancients bold, allowing it to have and then to hold? I just love those lyrics. They're awesome. And they really bespeak to holding oneself true and being as true as you can in your relationships with other people. Honesty. Obviously, dishonesty is a form of boundary transgression. It's kind of a wimpy one, but it's still not cool, right? It beats the heck out of, you know, beating the crap out of somebody, killing them, raping them, murdering them, torturing them, whatever. But it's still not cool, you know. So if somebody's doing things that feel uncomfortable to you, ask them to stop. Always remember, you know, most folks aren't bona fide psychics by Duke University or any other, you know, empowering body. You have to communicate. You know, and I've said this before in podcasts, open, straightforward, honest, respectful communication is the key to just about anything. You have to let people know when they're doing something that you find uncomfortable. Most folks aren't mind readers, right? And most folks aren't keyed in to your personal likes and dislikes and your pet peeves. They don't know, right? People get around me, they don't know the certain music I don't like and certain music I do like if they don't know me that well, right? I mean, I was going up to visit a treatment site with a very cool gentleman who took me up to visit some adolescent treatment sites, and this gentleman had brought his iPod and was listening to a bunch of music, and some songs came on, and one of the songs came on was by a band I really despised their lead vocalist with a passion, and he realized it because he and I had had a conversation earlier about this particular person, one of the few tenors I don't like, and he was like, oh my gosh, and he's like going over to change the iPod song, and I'm like, dude, this is your car, this is your iPod. One song ain't going to kill me. You got it on shuffle, okay? It's not like you're playing, you know, three full albums by this group, okay? I'm going to live, you know? And he was like, oh, I'm really sorry. Well, come on. I'm in his car. Are you kidding me? Thank you for being that sensitive. And that was the point. He was sensitive enough to recognize that that was something I didn't want to hear. And then he went to change it and went to apologize. Well, no, that's an inconvenience. I really appreciated him doing that. That was uber cool of him. But, you know, most people aren't going to be that savvy. Most people aren't going to be that observant. This is a very unusual gentleman in that regard, and I really appreciate his ability to be able to do that. That's a rare quality in our society. You know, but again, you know, if I don't tell him that, if he doesn't know the song, you know, if he didn't know me well enough and didn't know that the band, I don't like the band, you know, whatever, there's no way he's going to know that. And I can't just sit there in the car. Let's assume he didn't know that and he's playing the song and I'm thinking to myself, oh my God, I can't believe he's playing the song. You know, and I start to get snippy and kind of get irritable. And then, you know, he's asking me a question or talking a conversation and I kind of snap at him. He's going to wonder what the hell's wrong. You know, you have to communicate with people. Tell them what your likes and dislikes are. I mean, be upfront with folks. I mean, one of the first things I do when I meet people, and I know it scares a lot of people off and runs a lot of people off and probably, you know, in some regards, probably costs me relationships. But honestly, I just don't care because, to me, it's very, very important for me to be who I am. And, you know, most people, when they get into relationships, they sort of do it gradually. So when they meet somebody, they're kind of on their P's and Q's, and, you know, they're real careful with their manners and what they say. That's not me at all. As kind of blunt as I am on these podcasts, this is pretty much how I am in real life. I mean, if you meet me, you know, I'm a little different than that when somebody comes into the office for services, because obviously they're coming into me for help and they don't know me that well. And, you know, I'm there to listen to them and help them out. I'm not there to scare the crap out of them. But if I'm meeting somebody socially or whatever, and generally, you know, I warn people. And eventually, obviously, if somebody sticks with me in counseling, they're going to know me, who I am, because I'm very blunt about saying, okay, just FYI, so you won't misperceive me, right? That's communication. So I talk to them about how I am and how I interact. And I say, you know, if I use language that you find offensive, let me apologize up front. I tend to be a little loose with my mouth, which is really not a good thing. And I'm working on it, but I'm obviously not working on it fast enough or arduously enough, or I'd have it under control by now. And, you know, most people will laugh. And I said, you know, but if I say something you find, you know, uncomfortable or offensive or whatever, bring it to my attention. You're not being rude, you're being honest, right? Part of what's important in a therapeutic relationship, as it is in any intimate relationship, emotionally, you know, significant relationship, is for you to be open and honest and direct, right? And most people won't take me up on that because they kind of feel uncomfortable because, you know, our social mores, our social customs are, oh, you don't say that thing, it's rude. No, it's not. If I'm doing something that you're finding annoying, please tell me. Now, it doesn't mean I'm going to quit, but if I don't know I'm doing it, I don't, and that you're finding it uncomfortable, offensive, whatever, I don't have the option to change it. I don't know. I'm not God. I'm not Jesus. I'm not going to look at you and intuit shit. I'm not going to hold my hands up and go, oh, I'm getting psychic vibrations for this person. Oh, my gracious goodness. Yeah, I mean, please. You know, you don't open your mouth. I'm not a mind reader. And so I really like to communicate with people. And I tell people that in relationships. Open your mouth. Make your wishes known. Make them known politely in a quote-unquote socially appropriate way. You know, you don't come out and be rude about it. But it's like one thing I tell people, I tell students when I'm teaching classes, the same thing. Look, I tend to be blunt. I tend to be a little, you know, sometimes a little over the top. If I'm doing things that are, you guys are and gals are finding annoying, please, you know, bring it to my attention. Doesn't mean I'm going to quit, but at least gives me the option to put a lid on my id if I decide to do it for the sake of the relationship, right? And sometimes I do. Sometimes if somebody says something and I think they have a valid point and I'm able to moderate it, sometimes I'll go, you know what, you're right. Thank you. And I always thank the person for bringing it to my attention. It don't always change, but I always thank the person for being open and honest, because that takes integrity. And I always, always, always respect integrity and honesty. I don't have to like what a person's telling me, but I have to respect that they had enough guts to tell me the truth as they see it. And I really, really respect that. So communicate with people what you want and what you don't want. Now, you don't have to be like me, you know, being my blunt self kind of right out of the box from day one. I don't warm up like most social people do. And, okay, well, I can't say that, and I have to kind of watch what I do, and I can't do this, and I can't do that because I want this person to not think I'm totally nuts and da-da-da-da-da. And then as our relationship grows, I'm going to expose more of myself, my interpersonal stuff, yada, yada. Oh, no. No, 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 no. I don't do that crap. I am who I am, almost out of the box like a racehorse. And if you don't like it, don't let the door hit you on the butt on the way out. Or make a comment about it and ask me, can I moderate it, or would I moderate it, or please moderate it because you're finding it offensive. Right? All I can say is no. Right? And if I do say no, I'm going to be nice about it. I'm not going to go, you know, fuck you. I'm not going to be rude and, you know, obnoxious about it. But if I don't know, I can't change it. I don't even have the option to change it. And the reason I don't wait and kind of warm up to people and, oh, my God, and I realize I scare a lot of people away doing that, you know, and I warn students about that, and, you know, and if a patient sticks with me, I kind of warn them about that and say, look, I'm just kind of blunt and I don't mean anything by it. Please don't take it personally. Yeah, I mean, I go way out of my way to make sure that people understand that I'm just being this kind of guy and it's nothing personal. I'm an equal opportunity bigot, kind of like nature. I do it with everybody. And, you know, if you find you're offended by it, please bring it to my attention and let's talk about it, because that's what relationships are. They're about communicating honestly and directly and as with as much respect as you can, quote unquote, depending on what respect means to you or me or whatever, because obviously that's a laden word that has many meanings to different people. But if you don't communicate, you don't know. But I'm pretty much who I am out of the box. And I do that because I don't have time for social conventions that may or may not work out. I mean, how do you know this person's going to be a long-term friend to you? You won't know. You spend 3 to 4 to 5 to 6 months getting to know this person, and then you find out that you don't really like them that well, and now that they're really showing who they are, you're like, oh shit, who is this person? Oh no. I have zero patience, time, or tolerance for that crap. I am who I am right out of the box, and here's the good news, right? If I don't scare the crap out of you, and you're not running around going, Lord, I'm just got a letter, nothing about beating with this boy, holy shit, right? If you don't run screaming out of the room like a burning fire, right? The good news is I never get any better, right? The bad news is you got to deal with me in full right now, out of the box, you know, not sanitized for your protection, as a friend of mine describes me on stage. He's a hoot. Love him. We're playing a gig, and the guy's introducing the band members to the audience, and he's like, and sanitized for your protection. it was great. It's a classic line. I love it. I'm not sanitized. I'm just kind of who I am. And, you know, some people really like that, and some people find it really obnoxious and annoying and frightening and uncool, and those folks tend to not be my friends, and those folks tend to not last with me very long as students or as patients, and, you know, that's okay. They need to get what they need. You know, if you're paying for a service, whether it's be it as a teacher or as a, client, you need to get what you pay for. Now, you need to get competency, but, you know, there's this client-patient therapist counselor/match thing going, student-teacher thing. I really believe that that's important. A lot of clinicians, particularly those who are more in the rational, emotive, kind of behavioral camp, and I am definitely there. I'm one of those guys and gals, but I'm not one of those guys that believes the relationship's not important. I don't believe it's necessary, but I do believe it's an important part, and it can make a difference in the long run. And I really try to give people the idea that I'm there for them and that I really do give a flip. But I'm also there for me. And I'm there for me first and foremost, because if I'm not for me, I can't be there for anybody else. If I'm only for me and I'm the selfish, you know, in a nasty sort of way, what I call narcissistic selfishness, then that's not a good thing either. So it's got to be this balance, right? But you've got to have a relationship and know who you are first. And if you're not comfortable with who you are, get comfortable with who you are. Know what your limits are. If you don't know what your boundaries are, a lot of people don't. You know, I work with folks and they say, I really have no idea. I've grown up under the shadow of my ex-husband or my parents or my wife or my girlfriend or boyfriend or whatever. And they really have no freaking clue who they are at their core when they strip away all the social programming and all the stuff they did with the other person. That's perfect time for self-exploration. Know who you are. Find out who you are. Whether that's asking people that know you really well, whether that's getting in some kind of counseling, therapeutic relationship, whether that's praying or meditating or whatever works for you, reading books, whatever works for you, do it. Find out who you are. Get friendly with who you are. Even the bad stuff, the so-called bad stuff, the stuff that you don't like, stuff that's not very pleasant to look at, right? Because you can always find ways around it, but if you don't know what's there, there's no way to cover it up. There's no way to work around it. There's no way to work through it. There's nowhere to hide it if that's what you want to do. There's no way to suppress it if that's what you want to do. You don't know what it is you're working with. How can you do it? That's like, you know, building a house with no floor plan. Or like so many of my colleagues do, who I don't respect worth a damn, is, you know, no testing on a patient. They come in and they say they're depressed, and they go, okay, you're depressed. Oh, please, don't even get me started about that. And you guys have already heard my shtick about that, right? Let's just slap a bunch of medication on them, or let's just start doing therapy with no idea what's really wrong with you. And maybe you do have depression. Well, what's causing depression? Well, my dog died. Well, that's real nice. What are those cuts on your arm doing? Oh, yeah. Well, did I forget to mention I've been doing that for the last 10 years? You know, please don't even get me started. But, you know, if you don't know who you are, you can't share yourself with another person, right? And I'm not suggesting any of us, you know, including me, and I know myself pretty damn well. Nobody knows himself or herself perfectly, right? But you keep trying. It's a work in progress. It's a process, just like life, right? It's something, this exploration thing is one of these lifelong dillies that you do, right? Hopefully, if you're like smart and give a flip. But become friends with yourself. Know who you are. Get very intimate with yourself. And once you do that, then you can make a decision as to what complements you and what you want out of a relationship and what kind of things you do and don't want. Go after the things you want. Avoid the things you don't want, right? Whether you're a social kind of guy or gal or an isolatory kind of guy or gal, doesn't matter. Figure out who's going to work with you, right? I mean, I have very few friends, and my definition of friends is probably different from most people. You know, my definition of friends are people who are really, really there, who you have a very strong bond with, who you're very intimate with. And again, I don't mean that in a sexual manner. Most of you guys and gals out there probably know that by now. When I say sex, I mean sex. When I mean intimacy, I mean closeness, close existential spirituality, whatever you want to call it. I have damn few friends. But the ones I do, I could count on through pretty much any damn thing on the planet, and I know that. And when I'm your friend, I'm like that. I have a lot of acquaintances. You know, let's do lunch, let's do dinner, oh yeah, you know, blah, blah, blah. But they're not my friends, they're acquaintances. A lot of people would consider them friends, I consider them acquaintances. And there's a big, for me, a big linguistic definitional situation that's hugely different between those two entities. Very, very, very different. I have very, 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 very few friends. I have a fair amount of acquaintances. Probably don't have as many acquaintances or friends as a lot of folks do because of my more social isolatory nature in general. I need a lot of quiet time and alone time with myself to meditate and communicate with God and all this kind of good stuff. And I joke about that, but I'm really serious when I say that. I'm not being, you know, facetious or sacrilegious or whatever. I'm really serious about that, you know. I think I said to folks before, every time I pick up a guitar is a form of communication with God for me, or Allah or Buddha or whatever your deal or deals is or are, or the force or whatever. That's my communication with the universe, and I really mean that, which is why I don't denigrate it by playing things that don't resonate with my inside energy. I don't care how much money or fame you got, I'm not interested. Right, I've turned down very lucrative gigs because I wouldn't play the kind of music that they were requiring me play to play the gig. I just wouldn't do it. And thank God I haven't had to do it. You know, I know a lot of people have to do that because that's how they make their living. And I get it. Sometimes we do things we don't like to do. But hopefully those things are fewer and farther between than more often, because that certainly distances yourself from yourself. And that's not a good thing. I think most people need to be intimate with themselves, need to know who they are, because they can't be intimate and respect other people's boundaries if they don't know what their own are. Knowing yourself is a way to make yourself aware of what you're comfortable with, what you're not comfortable with, and then communicate it with other people. Be open with it, right? If other people don't like it, show them where the door is. Show them how to operate the door handle. I mean, seriously, you're better off alone with yourself than you are in a situation where you're not happy because you're not getting your desires met because somehow somebody isn't clicking with you. That's not good. That's like transgressing your own boundaries. That's not a good thing, right? Never give in. Never give up. Never sell yourself short. Not a good thing. And don't do the same thing to other people. You know, if you're unsure about somebody's boundaries or likes or dislikes or comfort zone, ask them, right? Let them tell you. Learn from them. Best way to find out if you're doing something annoying is asking the person, do they find it, or are they okay with it? You know, it's a lot of people. In other words, nowadays, fewer people smoke than they used to, cigarettes, although a lot of folks still do, which is really amazing to me, but that's another topic. But, you know, people back in the day, you know, used to ask, it was sort of a pro forma, oh, do you mind if I smoke? And if even if you did mind, you kind of went, oh, no, I'm fine. Yeah, just give me a secondhand smoke and kill me. Right? People know better because I'm allergic to cigarettes. People know better than light up that shit around me. I get very, very verbal about it. I'm usually nice the first time, a little frantic, but nice the first time. Second time, I'm like, put that shit out now or I'm gone. I don't have time for that crap. It's just, and it's amazing to me, somebody who won't even ask. They don't see that the cigarette smoke is a boundary transgression. It's a huge boundary transgression. Anything you do that affects somebody else, and when you're in somebody else's presence, has the potential to be a boundary transgression for them. But you don't know that unless you ask them or unless they tell you. And a lot of people aren't going to tell you because they have this like, oh, I don't know if that would be polite or not. Screw politeness. This is about you and getting what you want and getting what you feel like you desire in life. You're not going to get there by shutting up and not verbalizing yourself. You can do it nicely. There's, you know, there's nice ways to say, gee, could you please not smoke? I'm allergic to cigarettes. I'd appreciate it if you wouldn't smoke right now. Or can you go outside to smoke? Or, you know, whatever. You know, can you chew tobacco and not spit? God, I have a story about that too. I won't gross everybody out about that one. But boy, whew. Ooh. Anyway, I'm pretty verbal about it. And if I get around somebody, if I think something's going to offend them, I try to ask them first. I try to remember to ask them, hey, is this okay if I do so-and-so? Do you mind if I do so-and-so? Right? And I would hope that if somebody had a problem with what I'm doing, they would tell me. Right? Because what a lot of folks will do is they just won't call you up. They just won't come over. Or they won't ask you to do certain things, you know, because they think, well, he's going to do X, Y, Z, or she's going to do A, B, C, and I don't want him to do that, so I'm just not going to invite him to this situation. That's not good. That's not being honest with them or yourself. I mean, come on. You know, boundaries are very, very important, right? Everybody has them. Learn what yours are. Ask other people to respect them. Folks who won't respect them, I don't care if they're your kid, your dog, your mom, your dad, your husband, your lover, your wife. I don't give a flip. Ask them to honor your boundaries. Now, you know, don't have ridiculous boundaries. Don't show up in a, you know, contamination suit because you think there's some, you know, weird space vibes coming off somebody's hair or something. I mean, you know, you can't be stupid about it and weird and crazy about it. But, you know, if you've got like normal vibe dillies, it's like not everybody likes to be hugged, right? Some people really have a problem with that. And a lot of times, you know, and I'll tell folks that I'm working with, you know, because sometimes some of the folks I work with get real emotional. And sometimes if I were in that same situation, I would like it if somebody put their hand on my shoulder or, you know, touched my top of my hand kind of in a, you know, friendly kind of way, kind of a supportive kind of way. But I always ask folks, I don't assume that they want me to touch them or hug them or put my hand on their, you know, whatever. It's like, no, that's manager transgression. I know you're trying to be nice, but, you know, and it is funny because I inherited a new set of folks, a couple that I'm working with, and the husband came in of the couple, and it's a heterosexual couple. The husband came in and shook my hand, you know, held his hand up to shake, you know, it's a very traditional American kind of thing to do, and you know, and I'm like, okay. And the wife didn't hold her hand out, and I didn't offer my hand because a lot of, you know, I find women do less handshaking than guys. And I don't know if that's like a social moray kind of thing, or I don't know what that is, but I find it to be true. So anyway, at the end of the session, the wife said, by the way, said, do you mind if I ask you something? I said, no, you ask me anything you want. She goes, I noticed you shook my husband's hand, but you didn't shake my hand. I said, well, that's because your husband offered his hand to me first, and you didn't. I said, had you offered your hand to me, I'd have been glad to shake it. And she started laughing. She goes, oh, I just thought you had something like you didn't want to be sexual or something. And I just started laughing, and I was like, no, trust me, that was not the case. I said, but, you know, I don't like to do things unless somebody makes the first move in the social kind of situations because I don't want to be a boundary transgressional. And it was really interesting to see her reaction to that. She's like, wow, I never thought about that. And I'm like, well, you know, it's like all these people like to warm up and hug people and they're like, oh, I'm a huggy person. And they come up and hug you. They don't even ask you, do you mind if I hug you? You know, and I personally don't care. I mean, that's cool if you want to come up and hug me. But there's a lot of folks, I mean, I've got a really good friend out in San Jose who is really, excuse the pun, and I'm not being punny about this, is really touchy about that stuff. He doesn't like to be touched very much. He doesn't like to be held, you know. So I'm always very careful about, hey, are you okay shaking hands, you know. And I'm not being funny. I mean, this guy's real sensitive to that kind of stuff. He's not a touchy-feely kind of guy. And, you know, whereas I may want to show him how much I appreciate him by coming over and hugging him, that's not appreciating him. Appreciating him is honoring his boundaries, right? And he was really upfront with me pretty early on in our relationship, getting to know each other, that, you know, he was kind of, you know, he was asking me, oh, you know, do you know people that are kind of touchy and people that aren't? And I said, yeah, you know, and so we talked about it. And he says, yeah, I really don't like it when people do that. That was great information for me. I really appreciated him saying that. You know, that was really cool. A lot of times people will have a session with folks and patients will say, do you mind if I come over and hug you? That was a great session. And I'll go, yeah, sure, that's fine. I'm okay with that. But I really appreciate the fact they asked me that. That was very, very cool. That was showing knowledge of, awareness of, and respect for their own and other people's boundaries. That's really, really, really important. So don't minimize personal boundary space. It's our responsibility to know what ours are and to communicate it honestly and respectfully and nicely as much as we can to other people, and to bitch smack the hell out of them if we ask them nicely not to transgress our boundaries and they do it anyway. Some people seem to think that's a funny thing to do, it like a kind of a pet peeve joke that they pulled, kind of like, you know, a one-upsmanship or something. I don't think it's amusing at all. And if people do that shit with me, it ain't a way to make me your friend or to get invited to my dinners. It's just not going to happen. So make sure that you stand firm with your boundaries, whomever it is you're with, and make sure that you know what they are, and make sure that you respect and honor and ask other people if you're unsure what their boundaries are, because that's just really, really important. Don't assume anything, and don't let anybody else put any assumptions on you either. Know and respect and love yourself. Know and respect and love other people. You don't have to like them, but you do have to love them as a human being, or at least it would be better if you did, and that would be kind of cool. And if we all did that, we'd be in a whole lot better world. We wouldn't have shit that happened over the last couple of weeks in Ohio and Boston. That kind of stuff just blows my mind, no pun intended. It just really, really blows my mind, particularly the fact that I know some very responsible religious people of all sorts of various faiths. And, you know, how anybody that belongs to any major organized religion, whether it's Islam or Christianity or Buddhism or Shintoism or Judaism or whatever, most rational religions and varieties of those have an anti-killing clause in the contract that you sign up, you know, and how anybody can justify that crap tells me they're either dumb, crazy, or a cluster B personality disorder, because that's just wrong, and sorry, that's just wrong. I don't care who you are. Anyway, enough of my pontification. Thanks for listening. Hope you enjoyed the trivia facts, and hope that it was helpful. I'll be back again with another episode in the continuing saga. Thanks so much for listening, and don't forget, guys and gals, I am on the internet. I'm up for consultation. Video is me, and audio is me. Wherever you are, there I am. Whoop, there I is. Thanks. See ya. Be well.